This podcast is sponsored by PAX. Whether on water, on land, or in the air, PAX bags are both versatile and flexible backpacks that are perfectly suitable for your requirements in the most demanding of environments. PAX bags are highly regarded due to their exceptional performance in pre-hospital and in critical care environments. Renowned for their durability, they endure harsh conditions while providing rapid and reliable access to essential kit. So their well-organized compartments and customizable configurations enhance efficiency in high-stress situations. PAX bags are designed with infection control in mind and are easy to clean and disinfect. The highly visible colors and reflective strips add quick identification and adherence to quality standards, assuring reliability. The versatility of PAX bags caters to a diverse EMS providers, but also delivers vital equipment and durability and ease of use for pre-hospital critical care services globally. I've used PAX bags in a number of critical care situations and they're absolutely excellent. Please see the show notes for further details.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast. In this episode, I've got Kieran Rodwell with me. Kieran is a paramedic for London Ambulance Service who's currently seconded to London's Air Ambulance. Kieran is one of thousands of paramedics who in recent years has come to London to work as a paramedic from Australia. In 2020, Kieran became a huge driving force behind raising donations and awareness of the bushfires back in Australia, leading him to be awarded a VIP Employee of the Year award. He joins us today to talk about his experiences and give an insight into life as a paramedic in London. Welcome to the podcast, Kieran.
Thank you for having me on.
So let's get into it, mate. So Kieran, what made you want to become a paramedic and what brought you to London?
Yeah, so I think, to go right back to the start. So just to give some context, I grew up in a small country town in Australia, in a little town called Mombala. It's a small country town, 500 people, and I played a lot of sport. It was kind of what I did, what my family did as kids. And the main sport I played growing up was basketball. So played a lot of basketball, played rugby league, everything kind of get your hands on and just really enjoyed it. And then there was sort of a situation where one night after basketball training, someone really close to my family and my friends died, unfortunately. I was 16 at the time. And I remember sort of within that moment just being completely overwhelmed with the situation. Never really experienced anything like that before. And it was, you know, the paramedics came and unfortunately it was my basketball coach, Robert, he died. He had a massive MI. I just remember sort of how they handled the situation. I don't even really remember what they said, to be honest, but I remember how they made me feel and my sister and my mates and that at the time. And I think within that moment, it was a very sort of raw experience for me. And I just remember, I was like, wow, like, you know, they've guided us through this moment. That's a pretty amazing thing. And my mum's a biology teacher. She's a science teacher. And I was always interested in sort of physiology, pathophysiology in the human body. And it seemed like it may be a combination of those things. So that moment within my life, as well as sort of personal interest with, learning about the human body. And it seemed like a good mix. For me, so it just progressed over time, and then I went to university at Charles Sturt University in Bathurst, in Australia. And I remember, so I decided after that sort of point that I wanted to be a paramedic, and just see where that would take me. And I had a mate, Joey Platts, so I'm not sure if you've ever met Joey, but he's from Mombala as well, so we grew up in the same town. He's a few years older than me, but when he was finishing university, he was in the very first cohort of Australians that was coming across. And I remember chatting to him. He used to work as a lifeguard at the pool, and he just come down for a day. He's like, oh, mate, like I'm moving to London. I was like, what do you mean? Like, why are you going to London? He's like, oh, I'm going to work as a paramedic there. And yeah, I remember thinking at the time, I was like, I didn't realize this was a thing. I'd never been overseas before I moved here. And I just thought coming to London would be an awesome opportunity to work and, you know, through that period. So that was right at the beginning of my university, and I spent 3 years researching about it, learning about how it sort of works, the different, you know, exposures that you would get in London compared to different parts of the world. And then, yeah, I was like, okay, yeah, I think I'm going to do this. Kept in close contact with him, and he was having a great time. He messaged and, you know, just tell me the reality of the situation, and everything, and I thought it'd be a good opportunity to move overseas, sort of go on a bit of an adventure, and yeah, work in a different country and all that sort of stuff. So yeah.
And what year was this, Kieran? What year did you qualify and come over to London?
Yeah, so I finished university in 2017, and then I moved over here February 2018.
Awesome. And I think if I'm stands to be correct, I think the first cohort, like Joey's lot, were probably over in about 2014. Does that sound right?
Yeah, so I think it would have been early or the end of 2014, early 2015, around that time.
The Trailblazers, the first
lot. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So mate, tell us a little bit. So I think something like a third of paramedics in London are from Australia now. There's some statistic out there. I'm not sure if you're aware, but I think it's as much as a third of all paramedics in London are from either Australia or New Zealand. It's an incredible statistic. How have you found it? What's working in London like so far?
Yeah, I've loved it. I mean, it's been unreal. I think initially I was only going to stay here for 2 years. I think there's a lot of Australians that come across and they think they're going to do their 2 year sort of sponsored visa. But no, I just fell in love with it really quickly. For me personally, it was a big change. So as I said, I'd never been overseas before I moved over here. Just jumped on the plane with a few mates and came across. I always knew that I wanted to work in London throughout that time, so I didn't apply for anywhere in Australia to come across. But it's good, like working in a large city, metropolitan area, the exposure is really big. Had a pretty sort of a varied experience in regards to different roles I've done. Started out in Ilford. So I started in Ilford on a DCA working on a truck. And it was great. I had a really good experience, met a lot of really good people, and then just developed over time. I think from my perspective, sort of probably being Australian, it sort of develops incrementally. So coming over and, you know, you've got to get your driving sorted. So spending 14 months attending, being a tender, I think was perfect for me. Like I needed the experience, I needed the exposure to patients. And then, yeah, developing. So you know, get your driving course done and start working on a fast response vehicle, developing through that. Being first on scene to jobs and learning all those kind of things, and then worked on TOU and worked in the clinical hub and now in HEMS as well. So yeah, it's been a really good experience working all over London, different parts and different roles as well.
Yeah, it's a lot of that's a busy 5 years, mate. From 2017, yeah. You've crammed a lot in that time. Fair play. I guess another question. There's other ambulance services in the UK that have been recruiting internationally over the last few years. Was there anything in particular as to why you wanted to come to London, or you had friends? I know that you said you had friends that had been working here, but was there anything else in particular?
So I think the big driving force was just probably familiarity with having some mates that are over here that had a really good experience as well. I wanted to live in London itself for the city, and just everything that provides, just really busy. I've had a few mates that worked in CCAM or other areas as well. And then just how busy the work is, like the patient exposure is great. You get to experience a lot in a really short period of time. The call volume is really big. And through that, just developing yourself as a clinician, as an individual. And then the opportunity here as well. I really believe, you know, here in London, if you're willing to work hard and you're willing to push yourself, there is opportunities out there. And yeah, if you're willing to meet people in the middle with that, they'll give everything back to you. So it's been unreal. And that was something that sort of Joey always reiterated to me. And that was something that I was like, yeah, I'm really going to try and grab this both hands and take that opportunity.
Yeah, Joey was definitely a good one for that sort of thing as well. Going to turn into a podcast all about Joey Platts, isn't it? If he's listening. Cool. So could you tell us a little bit about, so for some of the listeners in the UK and people like myself who don't have any experience of the ambulance services in Australia, can you tell us a little bit about some of the differences between either working in London or your understanding of UK ambulance services compared to back home?
Yeah, sure. So I think, for me personally, I've never worked as a qualified paramedic in Australia. I did my student placements while I was at university. I did those in Maroubra and Auburn. So one was right on the beach and then one was in Western Sydney. I guess in saying that, that's probably a metropolitan area. Well, it is a metropolitan area, the major one in New South Wales. I grew up in New South Wales. Being in London, big city, really short commute times, getting to hospital really quickly, with a lot of different resources, whether that's a major trauma center or getting to a HAC. Growing up in Bombala, there's very limited sort of resourcing being in a rural environment. So the distance to hospital time is massive comparatively. It might take you upwards of an hour and a half, 2 hours to get to an MTC or to get to a hack as well. But yeah, so I mean, a lot of my experience was only going to be from what people have told me or what I've read as well. But yeah, I think, as an overarching thing in the UK, you've got the NHS. So the funding is sort of a universal denominator between all the different areas. Whereas in Australia, you have, state-run bodies. So each individual state has their own ambulance service, and that has positives and negatives either way. And then you've got the Medicare as well. So Medicare, I guess, is the equivalent to the NHS, really. But there is a levy for ambulances, and you will have to pay a fee if you have that unless you have private cover. But I guess that's like an overarching thing. Maybe a few differences within the service itself. So in Australia, we only have paramedics, whereas in the UK, we've got EECs, we've got AAPs as well. So a little bit different within the systems. And then, yeah, I think as I said, like the call volume in London is massive. You have to see a lot of different things. But then we have the different challenges of what they have in Australia with the longer transfer times, depending upon where you work, being stuck in some really rural environments, difficult extrications. And yeah.
So just to confirm, mate, so there's a like two-tiered emergency healthcare system in Australia, is that right? So if you've got like private medical insurance, it's Medicare, is that the name of the
Yeah,
organization?
so Medicare is like I mean, it'll be available to everyone. And within that, it'll cover different things. So it depends on sort of your status. But if you do call an ambulance and you don't have private health cover, then you will have to pay a fee for that. It's not expensive to get ambulance cover. It's just like a monthly sort of payment. But within the UK, that would just sort of be covered straight away by the NHS. And dependent upon sort of your financial status, that'll be a different thing in Australia. But for example, like even where I went to school, the hospital was literally across the road, and people would, say someone would fall over and break their wrist in the playground. But if they got an ambulance and it was literally across the road, there would be a fee for that. But it just depends on the family and the individual's sort of circumstance.
So do you think, just as a genuine question, do you think that as a result of the way the systems are set up in Australia, there's a different, if you were to work, say you're working in a critical care team in Sydney, do you think there's a difference in the sort of exposure to certain patients you might get as a result of the requirement to pay a fee, or if it
No, I don't think so. Not within like a critical care. I think that would be different. So I think critical care is a very different situation, but just as a baseline, frontline ambulance. I think if you fit the picture for requiring a critical care intervention, then you'll get that and it'll be covered.
So pretty comparable to the UK then.
Yeah.
Cool. So could you, mate, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you became involved in raising awareness for the bushfires back in Australia. I know it was a few years ago now in 2020, and clearly it's probably sadly not an issue that's going to be kind of going away anytime soon, what with climate change and everything. But you were quite sort of front and centre, certainly of a campaign to raise awareness, if you like. In London, all around it, and yeah, and to be fair, it's not something that I would have known a great deal about other than what I'd seen on the news had it not been for all the stuff that you were doing. So, how did you get involved in that? And yeah, can you tell us a bit about what that whole experience was like?
Yeah, so I think it was just one of those situations that arose. I think bushfires in Australia aren't uncommon, especially every summer. It is normal to have bushfires, but the magnitude of that at the time was pretty horrific, to be honest. Deeply affected me and my family as well. So fortunately, we had two distant family members that died in the fires. And it was a really difficult time for me personally, as well as I think a lot of Australians. Both, in Australia, but also here in London as well. The way that I kind of got involved with it was there was a team leader, Debbie Richmond, who contacted me and just said she'd seen it on the news about the bushfires. Was there anything that, as a team leader, could there be any support that was organised for Australians? And I think it was a really thing that I'll be like really grateful for, to this day and forever, really, because it was tricky. There's a lot of Australians that were still going to work and trying to look after the people of London to the best of their abilities, but they've got all of this stuff going on back in Australia, which was presenting some really big challenges. And just sort of like mentally going back through that, the timelines within Australia and the timelines here in the UK were making it really difficult. So, you know, I had a lot of friends where we're getting information about where the fires were and sort of who was in danger at that time, depending upon where they lived. And, you know, you'd be, if you're on a night shift, it's fine because then you can communicate to your family. But throughout the day, the greatest, you know, threat to life was in the middle of the day when it would be the hottest. And then that's when the fires would move rapidly to different locations. So, you know, you're trying to be at work and you're trying to be present and trying to do the best you can for the patients in front of you, because in all honesty, that's what they should get. That's what, you know, anyone should expect. But then you've got this thing in the back of your mind where, you know, you're worried about your family and, you know, essentially, is your family going to be alive? Are you going to be able to contact them? Is everything going to be all right? And it felt like a very powerless situation. So I think by Debbie contacting me, she just asked the question, is there anything that can be done? Can we support you guys in any way? And I hadn't really spoken to anyone about it except for sort of my close mates and my crewmate at the time. And I just said, yeah, I think there's probably a lot of Australian people that needed some support at the moment. They've probably got a lot going on and maybe they haven't expressed that to you. And that sort of just developed over time. So through that sort of really, I guess, short period, maybe week and a half, 2 weeks, you know, I had mates that they, you know, the fires are going through, they're burning down telecommunications towers, so they can't even contact their family and they're not sure what their status is, and yet they're still here. And they're also stuck in the UK because they can't get flights back to Australia at that point because the smoke was so bad, so the flights were unable to land. I was just like, yeah, I think they're probably going to need a bit of assistance. And then that sort of developed in a way where it wasn't anything, you know, that I expected, and I think it just happened organically. But then the communications team got involved. So with that, then the London ambulance communications team got involved and said, okay, I think, you know, we'd like to do some fundraising. Is that something that you'd be interested in? And I said, well, yeah, if you can raise any money for what's happening, that would be incredible. Raise some awareness. And yeah, then BBC ended up getting involved. So did an interview with BBC, which was publicized in, you know, the news slot, just raising some awareness. And through that was able to, with the assistance of everyone, raise £10,000 for the Red Cross.
Mate, it's awesome. And even though I know it was a few years ago now, you know, it must be really difficult being over here and having all this stuff going on back home, and almost like you said, they're sort of feeling helpless, being so far away, different time zone completely. But yeah, I think it's, I remember at the time, I just think it's a really, really awesome story, an awesome example of, you know, how people support each other in London. I think, you know, when you work somewhere where it can be really tough and it can be really challenging, actually, like, you know, in my experience, I feel like these are the places where often you feel like people support each other the best because of the nature of the work and stuff. Does that echo your sort of feelings?
Yeah, massively. You know, I think people maybe see it on the news, but when you see someone that it is personally affecting, it resonates a lot with you. But no, the support was incredible all the way from, you know, team leaders, just having conversations with like different, you know, different colleagues and that kind of thing, and just, you know, asking if you're all right or is there anything they can do to help. And then, you know, I'll be forever grateful for all of those interactions, all the support. And then, yeah, the people of London as well, you know, they donated to a cause in a very, very far away location, like 17,500 miles away. But, you know, it resonated with them and meant something to them. So that's something personally I'll be forever grateful for. Definitely.
That's awesome, mate. It's really good stuff. Tell us a little bit about Yusuf Convent so far. How's it going? You're 7 months in now, is that right? 7 months on London's Air Ambulance. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so 7 months in. Yeah, it's been unreal. It's been something that I've wanted to do for a really long time. And yeah, generally, I've absolutely loved it. I started in June of last year, which is good. Was in the summertime, so had the extended flying hours as well. But no, it's been great. I think for me personally, you know, Dean Bateman rang me and said I got the job, and congratulations. And then Lindsay rang me a couple of days later and was like, can you start next Monday? And I was like, I mean, yeah, I can. So it was really exciting. But I was just aware, it was a big step up, and a lot to learn in a really short period of time, especially through that the sign-off period, which if anyone's ever been through, they understand how challenging that can be. But the support was amazing. Within that, I did say to Lindsay, I was like, I am starting quite quickly. I might need a bit of extra time, but in saying that, everyone was so supportive and, going out to the pad, everyone was really gracious with their time. There's so much learning up there. And, if you're willing to meet people in the middle, they'll give you everything you need. So yeah, it's been incredible.
And what's it been like that transition from Band 6 paramedic? You were doing TRU, Tactical Response Unit. If anyone's listening who's not aware, is the sort of like the dedicated police support paramedic car in London, if you like. You've gone from that working on an ambulance to all of a sudden, you're a HEMS paramedic for London's Air Ambulance. What was that transition like? If you can give people a I guess people that are listening that might be interested in sort of following your footsteps, a bit of a taste, a bit of an idea.
Yeah, so it was definitely a steep learning curve, massively, but super rewarding as well. And still, I don't feel like you can ever know enough about the critical care aspect. There's always learning that can be done every day. It's a constant process. But yeah, so I was, as you said, like I was on TRU, and then I started on HEMS. For that process, you've got your sign-off month, or it's been extended a little bit now. It's about 6 to 7 weeks. Within that time, you've got a portfolio to do. So you've got your sign-off pad document, which you need to get signed. And then all of your exposures to, the different equipment, critical care interventions, critical care drugs, and then just the jobs that you go to in that time. So the way it worked for me, and I think it's a pretty standardized process, but you'll come up to the pad, have an introduction day. They'll go through everything, the helipad, sorry, at the Royal London Hospital. And you have your introduction. And then, yeah, you'll do an observer shift where you're literally just in an observer capacity just to see how the day runs. Not expected to, do anything or, yeah, just observe. And then pretty much the next day you'll be the paramedic, but very much in the assistance of a senior member of staff, or, a senior HEMS paramedic who is there to guide you through everything, and develop as you are. I think my beginning was pretty steep in regards to the patient exposure, and that was good in regards to, you want to get stuck in and learn and take the most out of the opportunity. But yeah, in between the clinical shifts, so it's a very learning based environment. So throughout the year, there's always generally going to be a new paramedic and a new doctor. So everyone's aware that while you're on shift, you're there for the patients, and you're there to respond as appropriately. But throughout the day as well, you're always sort of just ticking away, going through SOPs, going through different kit, learning through different kit, and then everything that comes with that. So it's a very sort of dynamic 12 hours, depending upon what you're doing. But yeah, so throughout that period, the 6 or 7 weeks, going through all of the different pad documents, learning the SOPs, doing moulages, doing all the different sort of rapid reviews and D&D discussions as well, and then just developing yourself over that period. So then you'll kind of have like a penultimate day where you'll do your sign-off day. And your sign-off day will be at the conclusion of that 6 to 7 weeks, where you'll be assessed by one of the senior leadership team, as a paramedic. For the doctors, it's a little bit different. I have one of the consultants there that'll be with them. And on that day, you'll be quizzed pretty much from the beginning to the end, depending upon sort of how busy you are. So you'll be going through SOPs. They'll be asking you to do moulages. They'll be assessing you on sort of your performance on jobs, the CRM, and then just sort of, I guess, your general sort of demeanor and how you conduct yourself throughout the day. They want to know that you're responsible, you know that you're capable. And in all of these situations, it's really important because, through the day shift, you might have a 3-person team, but on the medic 2 shifts or medic 3, generally medic 2, you'll be with a registrar. They might be in the same sort of equivalent time frame, and you're succumbing as well, and you're going to be going to all these patients as well. So have to be ready to go with everything.
You said a little bit there about being assessed on your CRM. So just to throw this one in, what sort of things, what are good examples, in if from your point of view, your opinion, good examples of CRM, or how do you go about your CRM, your crew resource management, and what sort of things have you been either given as feedback or have been are almost like good standards of CRM at London's Air Ambulance?
Yeah, so I think maybe if I kind of like zoom out, then I'll come back into me personally. But I think when you start, well, when I started, you know, you kind of got this idea of what you think the perfect job is in regards to how you can get everyone and get to where you need to go. But I think in those snapshots of those different job presentations, you just got to develop. So you're probably with people you've never met before. You're with patients who are really sick, who need interventions really quickly. And I think it's about quickly developing a rapport with your colleagues that are with you from London Ambulance Service, and then optimizing that environment for everyone to the best they can, so they can work to their full capacity. And then from that, then it comes back to the patient as well. So, you know, introduce yourself, be polite, just say to them, okay, where are we at, guys? What are your plan? What have you found? And then sort of within that team dynamic, within London Air Ambulance, the paramedic and the doctor have sort of designated roles within that situation. As a paramedic, you'll be sort of running the scene, making sure scene safety, appropriating kit, and then the doctor will be doing their primary survey, trying to see their findings, and then working out what the appropriate pathophysiology or the pathways for that patient. As a paramedic, you need to kind of have eyes, like one ear in as to what the doctor's finding. They'll usually be verbalizing what injuries they've found with the patient, what their concerns are, as well as getting everyone from the London Ambulance Service to, you know, do your coma and get all of your processes started as well. So I think really quickly identifying where the team's up to, and then what skills they can do on scene, and giving them an opportunity to do their skills, because that's what they should be doing, so that you can get multiple things done in conjunction at the same time. So I think that's my experience, and that's something that, you know, I've tried to develop throughout, because maybe not working in the LAA system, you know, I'm used to working on a car by myself. You rock up and you just get stuck in and do things at the same time. But sort of managing that scene where you've got multiple things happening, and we're getting access, we're getting the packaging done appropriately, is the blood getting done or a kit dump, and how can we shave time off efficiently to get to this person to definitive care or that intervention that they need really quickly, is a constant process trying to refine all the time.
Without getting stressed and shouting and losing the team, right, is so important. I think CRM's probably, and I'll be you know, if you disagree, please say, but I think it's probably one of the most important you know, sort of characteristics, if you like, of a good HEMS paramedic. You know, it's little things, isn't it? Using names, I think just trying to be like a human being, a normal person, you know, not trying to be like a robot, or, you know, anyone different than you are when you're having chats like this with a mate. Just treating people like they're people, right? Recognizing that they're stressed and we're working in stressful situations. And it's really different as well, isn't it, when you know you're used to turning up first when you were out on TLU, to now turning up slightly more mature scenes, perhaps seeing your colleagues, either ones that you know or ones that you don't, creating these flash teams, but you're now turning up later with someone else, you know, on a big red helicopter wearing orange, and you've got to you know, you've got to I think it's sort of insert yourself into that environment. Team insert sounds like the wrong word, but you know what I mean. To try to for the benefit of the patient, to try to all come together and you know, move towards the same shared outcome, right? But yeah, it's definitely having that recognition that you know, who's really stressed, who's really struggling. And I think the big thing for me has always been almost putting the needs of the team, the needs of my colleagues, on an equal footing as that of the patient. because, you know, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, or you think feel differently, but you know, HEMS team can't look after in that those initial stages, they can't do all of that stuff that needs doing by themselves. Like, you're reliant on the team. There's a reason, you know, we send lots of people to these types of jobs, right? That sort of ring home. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. Like, none of this stuff you can get done by yourself. And for that patient experience, for that patient outcome, it's really going to be how well you work as a team all together. And I don't mean, you know, separate, but everyone on scene from different agencies as well, different, the police, from the fire service, from everyone, how you can get people on side quickly, identify where you need to go, and then just rapidly push those interventions to get the patient to where they need to be. It's definitely a skill, one that I think probably all of us are trying to improve and refine over time. I think, as you said, like, it's just about just being a decent person and, you know, speaking to people, and then really, trying to push the pace and push that momentum on those jobs.
And it's an awesome thing when it comes together, isn't it? Touching on that, do you think you could maybe talk us through what's the typical day for a London HEMS paramedic? And I know obviously there's depending on the day, you're kind of almost working in a slightly different setting. So can you maybe talk us through that? And do you have any that what days that you prefer? Or give us an insight, mate.
Yeah, so I think there's a few sort of different shifts that you do on LAA. So you've got the medic one, you've got medic two, and then medic three. I'll probably go through medic one. There's a daily routine. So there's a set, it's quite ordered, it's quite structured. And I think that's quite valuable for what it is as well. So normally the shift will be from 6:30 to 6:30. That'll be a normal day shift, 12-hour shift. You'll take a handover from the night team, generally up at the pad, or dependent upon, you know, if they're out on the job, or maybe you'll meet them downstairs as well. But normally you'll take a handover from the night team. They'll just pass on any sort of, if there's been any kit issues, what the status of the blood is, and then what vehicle you're on. So you'll have that very formalized conversation in the morning, and then you'll go from there. So within London's air ambulance, we don't fly at night time. So only flying within the day sort of period. And the aircraft will come in from north of 8 a.m. So generally what will happen is you'll be up on the pad, you'll take your handover, you get your kit, and then go down to the car. So go down to the vehicle, do your car checks, so do all your appropriate driver checks and check all the kit in the back. Generally, this will be, say, on a medic one shift, you usually be a three person team. That'll usually be, depending upon the status, but two paramedics and a doctor, or one paramedic and a doctor. Generally, one will be training, so the consultant or the doctor or the paramedic and a senior paramedic. So you'll go through your car checks, kit, and then someone will, or usually the consultant will go and get the blood. So the blood gets switched out every 24 hours, come back to the vehicle, and then from there, usually go and get a coffee or get some breakfast, and have a conversation about the day. Depending upon sort of the training status of what the team is at that point, usually you start talking about SOPs or some moulages, or just any specific goals or aims throughout that shift. One thing that I think I kind of quickly identified was it's really important to come to shift with some aims and some goals from that 12 hours, especially during your sign-off. But I mean, you can do it for any shift. So, you know, you're working with people from a massive amount of experience who have a wealth of knowledge in pre-hospital care or in hospital law, from anywhere really. And it's a really great opportunity to learn, and they're really willing to give you that as well. So you'll go get breakfast, have a general conversation about whatever, or your SOPs or some kit. And then at that point, the aircraft will normally come in at 8 a.m. So it's important to be back on the pad, essentially right up on the 17th floor for when the helicopter comes back, just in case there is a job that comes in. Then you can immediately jump on the aircraft and go and attend a case. So yeah, you'll have that. Then from there, within London, we obviously have like a really large built up metropolitan area. So you need to have the availability of the aircraft, but also the car as well. There is a designated footprint within London where it has been tracked, and it is faster to respond by vehicle. So we always have a car, which will be downstairs, and then the aircraft that's always primed and ready to go. So from there, you'll check the aircraft, make sure everything is fine with that. And then normally you do your daily brief. So daily brief will be with the medical team, be with the pilots, and it'll be with the fire crew for the day as well. Usually done about 9 a.m. And then from there, again, you go through sort of, is there any kit issues for the day? Is there any road closures? Is there any training specific areas that need to be done? Have a discussion about who's the primary team. Usually within a 3-person team, you'll still have a primary doctor and a primary paramedic, and then the third person will assist if it's a, you know, it's a really sick patient and they need multiple interventions, or if anything happens on scene. So yeah, you'll do your daily brief, and then throughout the day there's quite a few admin tasks that need to be done just to keep up with the running of the helipad, making sure all of the kit's maintained. But this, I think, is really valuable as well because it enables you to stay really familiar with the kit. There's a lot of changes that happen all the time just in trying to improve the kit, improving SOPs, and it gives you an opportunity just to rehearse things so that when you need it quickly, you're good to go for that. So, yeah, generally there'll be monthly bag checks, so they'll have designated kit that needs to be checked throughout the day for dates. And then you've got your CD drug checks. So you do your CD drugs, make sure they're all squared away appropriate. Another thing, and mind you, you know, I say all of this, but at all of these times, obviously, you could get a job depending upon where you are. So always ready to respond to a job. But this is other stuff that just happens throughout the day. So you do your drug checks, do your kit checks, and then you do rapid review. So rapid review is done with the team, can be included with the fire crew as well as the pilots. And this is something that I really appreciated and really enjoyed when I started. And I think it's really great because what they do is the debriefing process and the reviewing of the jobs is something at a level that I hadn't never experienced before. And I think it does a lot to improve sort of patient care and then just the general well-being of the team as well. So right from the very beginning of, all right, the klaxon's gone off, or there's been a job that's been sent down on the radio, how did we receive that? And at each of those points, so, you know, how do we go up to the aircraft? How do we get on the aircraft? Was there any issues with in planning or deplaning? And that review process of all the time can shave off seconds, can shave off minutes, and then you can get to the patient quicker. And, you know, if they're a penetrating trauma with bleeding, we know the time is ally. So that constant review of that process is really important. And that's what the rapid review is for. So yeah, the rapid review, you'll go through all of the jobs from the 24-hour period the day before, and through the governance app, you'll go through review sort of the timings, patient presentation, all of the interventions, and then have a discussion about, okay, so if we were faced with this job, would we have done the same thing? Would we have done the same interventions? And if it's a particularly interesting case, or maybe that's something that needs to be reviewed or some discussion, then it can be highlighted for D&D. So within D&D, it'll be highlighted. And then there's another opportunity again for the team to speak about why they did what they did or what happened. And then just develop that throughout the day. So, yeah.
And this is all before or even in between seeing any patients. Is that right?
Yeah, no, exactly. So, yeah, at all of these times, you know, the klaxon can go off and you could attend a job. So, there is quite a bit to do, especially on the medic one shift with that. But, no, it's good because, you know, you're at work, but then you're having these opportunities to review things. And I always think of it like mental models. So say that the team's gone to a job the day before, a patient presentation that maybe I haven't seen or I haven't experienced, then you can read through the governance and you can go through their thoughts and, you know, why they've done that. And then when you're faced with that patient presentation in the future, like, okay, so this is what I've experienced, this is what I've learned from this before. I think there's a lot of value from taking that away. And then you can even discuss it with the team. And then on top of that, if there's, you know, specific points that need to be highlighted, it'll go to a D&D process where, you know, on a Tuesday and a Thursday, there's an allocated 2-hour slot where the team will have an opportunity to just talk through the job, their thoughts and what they were thinking at the time, why they did what they did, their rationale, or maybe why they didn't do certain things. And I think that's invaluable. And that's something that I've I was super impressed with when I started on HEMS, because I hadn't experienced that before. And I think the value of that goes without saying. So yeah.
It's this concept of high performing teams, isn't it? And you're almost looking for those opportunities where, like, you know, it's accepting that so rarely will a job go completely perfectly well from start to finish. But looking for those opportunities to continually improve that growth mindset, that growth mentality. And yeah, it is. I remember when I first started in critical care, and you know, it was a real eye-opener. But at the same time, you know, you just have to sometimes it can be brutal, and I often feel like almost the worst critic of something when you go to D&D should almost be yourself, you know, because you know yourself what things that, you know, realistically you could have done differently. But it's great, mate. The thing that I'm getting out of this so far is that it's such a rich learning environment, and this, even though it's a secondment and it's 12 months, already, like, you're painting a really good picture of just like how much really like rich learning there is, and that's before you've even seen patients. Can you tell us a little bit about the role in EOC on the desk? I know from speaking to a lot of people, sometimes it's part of the role that people are a little bit either apprehensive about, or feel it might put them off coming to do a secondment working in the control room, just because it's an environment that's quite sort of unfamiliar to paramedics if you spent your entire career out on the road. But yeah, can you tell us a little bit about EOC, mate? What are your thoughts about working on the desk?
Yeah, sure. So I think the EOC perspective, maybe for people who don't know, so 50% of the role is in EOC. A normal sort of shift pattern will be two earlies, two nights. Your first early and your first night will be in EOC. So it is a really large part of your secondment, and it is really important. For me personally, I made the conscious decision before I started on HEMS to do a clinical hub secondment. The reason for that was firstly just to develop myself and learn and understand telephone triage as well as the system. So I was pretty lucky where I did it at the time where there was command point as well as cleric. So I learned both of the systems, which is really helpful. So if people are interested in sort of, you know, doing the HEMS role, I definitely recommend doing that. I think it's super valuable, just because it is a really large portion of the job. And then especially when you start with your sign-off period, there's a lot to learn in a really short period of time. You know, there's all the support that you need, but if you've already got some of that squared away because you have previous experience with the system, then it's definitely going to be a bit easier for you. But yeah, so within the EOC system, it can be really challenging. And I personally believe this is where you can do some of your best work. So in there, just maybe for people who don't know, you'll be in there and you'll be able to sign and interrogate calls. So when someone calls 999, you'll have your system in front of you and you'll have all of the jobs, all of the CADs up on your screen. The way it works through the APP system and the HEMS desk, you'll have it tailored. So you see all of the calls coming in, they'll only be a couple of seconds old, and you can quickly click on and sign and interrogate those calls. So within that, someone calls 999, they'll be speaking to the call taker, the operator, and you'll be doing a silent interrogation. So they won't know that you're there, but you'll be able to hear what you're saying. And then essentially through all of the ESC process, from my understanding, you're just trying to get information. It's all about information. How can you quickly identify patients that are really sick and patients that maybe need a critical care team quickly? And how can you efficiently get them there as quickly as possible for that patient? Yeah, you've got the silent interrogation, and there's a few different things that we're looking for. There has been a bit of a change within the end of last year where we had an immediate criteria. So there were seven immediates. So say if someone called, an example of that would be a fall from greater than 20 foot would be an example of an immediate. So if someone said someone had fallen out of a building and it was greater than 20 foot, you would just send the HEMS team as an immediate criteria, immediate dispatch. Other categories would be an interrogation. So you're interrogating a call, you're listening to it, maybe an RTC, a moped versus pole. And then you're listening, you can hear that the patient's unconscious, they're snoring, they need some airway support. They're going to potentially need an RSI, and that would be an interrogation when you send that from there. what's happened recently is got rid of the immediate criteria. So now there's only one immediate left and all of the rest are sort of clinician discretion. So an immediate would be just a one under or a person struck by a train. That being because the communication system, so a lot of the underground is really, really difficult and we don't want to delay getting the team to that patient who's probably going to be critically unwell. So within that, you've got your immediates and then you'll be listening to the 999 calls. And depending upon what they say, it'll sort of raise your threshold or, you know, swipe your sensors. And then we have the ability to actively interrogate. So we can request to be brought into the call. And then you can speak to the person who's dialed 999 directly and try and get some information. Within the call taker, they have a very specific script that they need to follow word for word. But on the HEMS desk, we can just ask sort of poignant questions that we think we need to get the information that you want to make the decision about, okay, is this a job where you need to send the team? Do we need to send a few more resources? So it's quite a dynamic environment. And I think it's one where there's a lot going on in a very short period of time. And it's about prioritizing tasks because you'll be there. And I know, Alec, you know this very well, but you'll be listening to a call and there'll be an RTC in West London and then there'll be a stabbing in East London and then there'll be someone who's been assaulted in South London and all of these things are happening at the same time. And you need to quickly identify how unwell the people are and what is the appropriate resources to get to them. And I personally quite enjoy the challenge. I think it can be really difficult. It's something within, again, the HEM service, I think we're always trying to refine. Jason Morris is the guru of the ESC, the HEMS desk, but we also have a D&D for dispatch specifically. So we had one a couple of weeks ago, but, if you've got jobs where, you know, you're like, okay, maybe we should have got the team there a little bit quicker, or we did really well with this one, and I think that went really good. Is there any learning that can come from this? It can all be highlighted for the D&D dispatch as well.
I think, you've really nailed it there, mate. I think at the start of, every sort of pre-hospitally critically injured person who goes on to have a really, really good outcome or, you know, as a survivor, goes home to their families, you know, the start of that journey was a really, really good dispatch. It's a great feeling when it all comes together. You're getting your colleagues on those right jobs, in a good quick time. Completely echo what you said, Matt. I think it's having clinician-led dispatch is a really, really good thing. Just talking a little bit about there about typical presentations. What sort of things are you like generally seeing when you're out and about? On Medic One, either by in the day by air or Medic Two at night. What are the typical presentations that you're seeing?
Yeah, so it's very much tailored to trauma, and I think that's to be expected. But it's a trauma service overarching. So your typical presentation would be RTC, road traffic collisions, from any mechanism, cars, lorries, mopeds. So a lot of RTCs go to a lot of stabbings. I think stabbings, penetrating trauma, make up a large majority of our care. Shootings as well, falls from height. So as I said, like greater than 20 foot or could be any mechanism dependent upon, you know, what's happened with that person. There can be work accidents, so on construction sites, issues with, you know, electricity, high voltage drills, scaffolding, people falling off or falling on top of them. What else do we go to? People trapped inside of vehicles, mainly from RTCs as well, but whatever mechanism. You've got your person struck by train, that's probably one that's quite unique to London. And it is quite a big presentation as well. Predominantly it is majority trauma, but we do go to some medical as well. And from my personal experience, a bit more medical than I expected. And that's generally because APP colleagues, you know, very, very busy. And maybe there is a patient with a medical presentation who does need a critical care intervention, but there's no APP available or no one to send. But yeah, massively, it's tailored towards the trauma aspect of the care.
And Kieran, I was wondering if you maybe talk us through some of your more challenging jobs since you've been on secondment. So obviously, without mentioning anything too specific, but just speaking generally, what made them challenging and what processes are there within the system to reflect and improve? I know you talked a little bit about D&D, but perhaps just as an opportunity to talk around sort of general well-being. Obviously, you know, you're being exposed to some really, really high-end, high-acuity stuff. You know, how do you feel the system looks after its staff? And yeah, just maybe if you could talk through some challenging jobs.
Yeah, so I think probably the one that comes to mind was actually one of the jobs at the last clinical governance day. So without being too specific, but it was a medic two job, early hours of the morning, about 1 a.m. It was a patient who was riding pillions, or she's riding, well, they were riding on the back of a moped on a major sort of motorway, and high speed collision into street furniture at about 50 miles an hour. I think it's probably worth mentioning we're on a medic two shift, so it's a two person team. We'd literally just greened up from a thoracotomy, so we'd greened up. It was like, yep, medic two, another job coming down. So obviously within that job, there was quite a lot of cognitive bandwidth which had been taken up, and then we've immediately been retasked to another job. It wasn't very far away, which is good for the patient, but then you know you're sort of in two scenes very quickly, straight away. The patient was there and was on a major sort of road, which presented challenges within itself because the road was still live. We were there very quickly on scene. And I know we discussed before about sort of rocking up to a more mature scene where there's more people there. But at this point, there was only an FIU that was there, and us and an IRO. The patient was critically unwell, essentially peri-arrest, at that time with a live road and quite a lot of danger to the team as well. So had to very quickly try and get rid of that danger, try and close the road as quickly as possible, as well as manage this patient who was critically unwell. Polytrauma patient, high speed mechanism, crashed into street furniture about 50, 60 miles an hour, not wearing a helmet. So extremely agitated. I think on arrival had a GCS of 10. But the most difficult thing, I think, from all of this job, and upon reflection, going through her injury, was she had an uncompressible subclavian arterial bleed from hitting street furniture about 50 miles an hour. I think that area specifically is really, really hard to manage. And in a pre-hospital situation, pre-hospital environment, you can't get definitive control of that bleeding. So with the patient, they had a head injury, they had chest injuries, fractured ribs with suspicion, well, definitely damage to the lungs as well, pulmonary contusions, abdominal injuries, suspected intra-abdominal bleeding, pelvic fracture, and had multiple limb fractures as well. So there was a lot to do from a critical care intervention in a really short period of time with a patient who's essentially peri-arrest, and exsanguinating from a wound that you can't control. In saying that, I think something from this job which was massively beneficial was the IRO was an ex-HEMS paramedic. And that was really helpful because from then we could, as a team, we could offload some of the packaging to them and we could just really smooth that process quickly. With the patient, they were very agitated and we were really struggling to get access for them to a point where they were so peripherally shut down from bleeding, you know, no radial pulse, very thready carotid pulse, tachycardic at 170. We had to try and get some sedation to just get control and went for an IO originally, always with the thought process of upgrading to IV cannulation or even a subclavian to get some filling going in conjunction with the sedation. And then, yeah, interventions from there were they were going to have blood transfusion. So that was always happening concurrently. The packaging was being done while I did my kit dump for the RSI. So they needed having blood. Well, sorry, they were having sedation. They were having blood transfusion. They were going to require an RSI, bilateral thoracostomies for blunt trauma with ventilatory failure, and then a discussion about, okay, so we've got a patient who we know has a vascular injury to their subclavian artery, or we have a high suspicion, that being from discoloration to the left arm, and no peripheral pulses, and a mechanism as well as a very large wound, essentially like a blunt transection of the anterior shoulder here. And then they also have a head injury, they also have intra-abdominal bleeding, and they have a pelvic injury as well. Just being aware the location we were, there was going to be quite a long scene time, commute time to hospital to getting them to a major trauma, and just balancing the priorities of how much intervention is appropriate for this person between getting them to definitive care. So we got through, so we did the sedation, blood transfusion, an RSI, bilateral thoracostomies, and then the thought process of, okay, we think they have a pelvic fracture as well. Do we potentially need to do a bowel for this patient? Understanding that that was going to take a period of time and going to delay us to getting to definitive care. And in that instance, was that going to be the rate limiting factor on that job? Was us doing that intervention? But then would that person survive to hospital without that? So that was a really tricky job for me personally. And there was a lot of like cognitive bandwidth that was taken up on that job, as well as having a really, really sick person, you know, that you're with, and you want to do the best you can for them. We made the decision just to do a 4 French invasive, with always the idea of if we needed to, then we could upgrade to an 8. When getting the 4 French though, at this point, the patient had already had 5 units. So their pressures had stabilized, thankfully. And we made the decision for rapid conveyance to hospital at that point, but always in the understanding that we could pull over if we didn't have control, thought was the pelvic injury, as well as everything else going on. So yeah, that was a really difficult job, but can definitely say, the person had a really good outcome, which was really, really positive to hear. So yeah, that's probably one of the more difficult ones I've had.
Mate, that's awesome. And correct me if I'm wrong, that sounds like a London HEMS team at full tilt. There's an awful lot of interventions there. And, you know, I think you're talking about Reboa, and, you know, she's obviously got this pelvic fracture, and she's code red too, you know. Yeah. But I guess even just putting, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but even just putting in the 4 French, you know, you're still part of that patient's journey. It's anticipatory, and you're almost expediting her care for when she gets to the hospital as well, but also making that decision that, you know, right now isn't the time to do, even though, you know, it's like you give someone a hammer, everything looks like a nail, but, you know, you've got this intervention, you've got this tool, but actually now's not the right time. But, you know, even listening to that, you know, popping in the 4 French, that's still helping out the receiving team at the MTC later on. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think for her, it was, we had no blood pressures at any time up until we had the 4 French, because we just weren't able to get any on the non-invasive. With that, it was we are really struggling and we're not sure of her perfusion status, but we need to have some definitive numbers in conjunction with, you know, the polytrauma. We want to maintain appropriate ICP with a patient with all of these other injuries, especially one that we are not going to be able to get definitive control over, even though packed this wound, but didn't feel, you know, you need surgical intervention to get control of that. But yeah, the 4 French was to get a blood pressure, an invasive blood pressure, and to give some real time second by second feedback, but always to have a really low threshold to upgrade to an 8 French and then go Reboa if needed. But thankfully, when the 4 French went in, that had quite a lot of transfusion at that point. And just have a really low threshold to put the 8 French in to do a zone 3 Reboa to get enough control to get them to hospital, to get them to theatre. I think as well, you know, we were saying before maybe about the differences within Australia and the UK as well. We had you know, we've got two blood boxes by default, but that sounds like a lot, but it isn't always. And depends upon where your patients are. Thankfully, you know, I say we had a long journey to an MTC. It's 25, it's 30 minutes. It's not an hour and a half, but all of these decisions like need to be factored in as well. And is that patient going to be able to tolerate that journey when we are getting to a more limited supply of blood? But it's critical that we give that, and yeah, do we need to upgrade from there? So yeah, cognitively a very tricky job, especially as we just come from another really big job. And like, I think you asked a question about sort of processes for, is there, if you just ask that again, what you said specifically?
Yeah, I think I'm talking about sort of like the, you know, there's certain things that you'd also do on scene that can expedite the patient's journey and the care once they receive the major trauma center, right? So in a full French femoral line, like even if it's not going to immediately impact your care and decision making on scene, perhaps because you've already made that decision, you're not going to do a bow, you're going to keep, you know, you're going to just keep moving towards hospital, get them in the ambulance transport, you know, that's still, you're still, they're the really, really key early building blocks that the MTC is going to want. That information, that bigger picture is probably not going to become quite clear until they're already at the trauma center, and then the receiving team can then look at the bigger picture from a more informed place as to whether or not to do certain things because of all of the work that you guys have done. So does that factor into it as well? Is that quite a big part?
Yeah, it can do. I think, yeah, if you have anticipated clinical course, and that can definitely be sort of a reason as to why you would, especially when you're talking about RSI. I think for her in this instance, it was just about trying to get those pressures quickly and then to give us a bit of an extra adjunct to see if we needed to upgrade for a boa. Thankfully, it was okay. But yeah, definitely value. And then they have a more definitive clinical picture when you arrive as well. But it's a balance, as you know, of, okay, we can do interventions, but is it the right thing to do these interventions? Because are we slowing, are we increasing our scene time? When for this person, they were a code red RSI with an uncontrollable, uncompressible hemorrhage, and we are not going to be able to, in a pre-hospital situation, get definitive control of that. So sometimes less is more, but then you need to do enough for them to manage that patient properly.
No one to cut your losses and yeah, and get him in, mate. It's great. It's an awesome story as well, and you know, like real testament to all the hard work, training, input that you know you've had since you've been there. So yeah, mate, it's great. It's a great story, and really great as well to hear that she's had a good outcome. What do you do on your days off, mate? How do you stay sharp? Like, how do you keep yourself you know, sort of in that, being an asset to the team and looking after yourself? I know you're big into your fitness, and probably I'm probably loading your answer there, but I'm sure there's more to it as well.
I really enjoyed like training, fitness. It's something that's always been a massive part of my life, even since being a kid. I've always enjoyed sports in many different sort of capacities, but the main ones that I do at the moment is I really enjoy strength training and strength and conditioning, and then I really enjoy martial arts as well, mainly Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So yeah, a lot of my time outside of work is doing that, and that sort of opens up different things, and you can do a lot of different stuff within that. So I think for me, it's always been something that's been consistent through my life, but it was something that's been really helpful having done even before I started HEMS as well, because it's kind of my default. And then looking after yourself. So training, sort of nutrition, sleep, general well-being, it's really, really important. Because as you said, you do get exposed to some really sick people and some hyper-acute scenarios. But yeah, I mean, within that, I think, you know, I've worked as a personal trainer in the past. That's something that I've done, and I've carried on that learning. It was something I did in my hometown. So yeah, I get my strength sessions in a week, and then I also do martial arts, Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Something that I started when I moved to the UK, and I'm pretty obsessed about outside of work. But it's great because, you know, you can go to class, you've got your coaches and you've got your teammates there, and it's a very social environment. So training you know, on my days off, I can go to like a lunchtime class, or I can go to an evening class. Usually, say if I go to a lunchtime class, I'll have a few mates there and we'll go and get a coffee afterwards. And, you know, these guys and girls, I don't know anything about, or they're not in the medical background, so you can just have a general conversation about whatever. But they're also curious as well. And it's just it's, you know, it's a really nice interaction because, you know, these are people that I probably wouldn't know otherwise. Like, I've got bankers, lawyers, IT people, musicians, photographers, people from so many different walks of life. And I find that stuff really interesting and really enjoyable. And yeah, just the thought process, I think it's quite similar with the martial arts in regards to, you know, the visualization, the rehearsing of specific scenarios, and the learning and the problem solving. It's quite similar. And I find that really rewarding. And then the strength training as well. So yeah, I've always enjoyed powerlifting, strongman kind of stuff. Dabbled in a little bit of sort of like CrossFit conditioning, but my flexibility isn't very good. So yeah, you know, usually just do my main compound list and then do some conditioning as well.
And hopefully, at least with the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I imagine it's completely different to work stuff, right? It's good to do. I always think it's good to do things that are completely different day to day work stuff. Unless you've had a complete CRM failure and you're grafting on the floor with an somewhere out of East London. But I imagine, mate, knowing you never have to pull out the martial arts on scene. Kieran, mate, just becoming into land, I thought a really good question to close it on would be to ask you what advice you would give to any aspiring paramedics that might be listening who are trying to break into the pre-hospital critical care or HEMS worlds. What would be your, sitting here now 7 months into your London Zero Ambulance HEMS secondment, what advice would you give to anyone listening?
Yeah, so I think if you know you're interested in it and you have a goal to work on a HEMS team, I think build yourself up over time. So for me personally, it was something I knew that I wanted to do quite early in my career, and then tried to do different roles within the LAS or whatever service you are that's going to really develop you for that. So, you know, it's really important just to develop yourself, kind of DCA, so develop your skill set. And then working on a fast response vehicle, working up, rocking up sort of first on scene, managing chaotic scenes by yourself, quickly identifying sick patients, sick pathophysiologies, and then getting the appropriate help there. Developing those, you know, we keep coming back to it, but those CRM skills, not just with LAS colleagues, but also other agencies, so the police, the fire. And doing that, and then working on TRU, that you know, that's another level again, and then working in the clinical hub, so through there learning the different systems from a London model per se, but learning how to use Cleric. It's going to offload a lot of your bandwidth when you sit on the EOC desk because you understand the system, and then you can just focus on the decision making.
Cleric's the software they use in the control room, right?
Exactly, yeah. So then you can just focus on interpreting the information and quickly identifying the critically unwell patients and getting them the appropriate help. But I think, you know, say like I go to a job and then we'll be doing the debrief afterwards, people sort of will ask me if I've done any extracurricular studies, and I've done my bachelor's at Australia, and, you know, I personally haven't done my master's, and there's a lot of people that have done it. And I think that's really valuable. But I think developing yourself, and I don't might, you know, sound whatever I was going to say, but just get the basics right. Learn how to do all of your skills really well, learning how to be rock solid in your own skill set, developing your CRM, and getting people on side, getting everyone those flash teams, as you said, working really quickly, working really effectively. And then within a HEMS specific, you know, take every opportunity you can. So there's clinical governance days the first Thursday of every single month. You're going to hear from some incredible speakers all around the world from different backgrounds. Going to learn about different jobs that the HEMS team, that the PRU teams go to. That's going to give you a massive amount of insight. And then I think, you know, doing your master's is great, and that's something that I will be doing in the future. But, you know, if you're on a job where you are with an APP or you're with a HEMS team, and, you know, they say at the end of the debrief or you're going through it, does anyone have any questions? So people don't seem to ask a lot of questions, but just ask. because, you know, all of these people have been in your position before. If you've got questions, I can guarantee that other people do have them as well. So, you know, please don't be afraid to look silly and just ask them about anything. And then, you know, oftentimes I'll say to people, if you want to send me an email about patient follow-up, please do. And then I can, you know, I can get that back to you, because I think it's really important to close those loops on patient presentations. And then you can just consolidate that information in your mind. So yeah, I think as a whole, just try and develop yourself over periods of time and put yourself in different environments, different roles, which is going to enable you to do that. And then if, you know, you do a job where you're with a critical care team from whatever aspect, try and make the most of that, ask questions, get yourself to clinical governance days. And then, you know, if you know someone who's worked in the HEM system or has, you know, they're an APP, you know, if you get along with them and just ask them what their thoughts on different things, you know, maybe, like, I think there's so much value, like, in a D&D, but just a general conversation. Like, for me personally, you know, like, I'm an audio learner, so I appreciate conversations I have with people. And like, oh, I had this job the other day, you know, what are your thoughts, or what would you have done? And over time, that'll start to rehash, and you'll learn, and you'll develop. And then when you do go to apply, you'll have a lot of information, and you'll have a lot of understanding that'll help you get to that level.
Mate, it's awesome. Yeah, I think it's really good. I think for so many people, it might seem like something they really want to do, but also might seem sort of, you know, unachievable, because it is difficult to get into. But, you know, I think sitting here listening to someone like yourself, you know, you've come over from Australia, never been to London before, and, you know, you live in proof that that it is doable and it is achievable. And yeah, like you said, just you know, just stick working on the basics, getting really good at your craft, at whatever you're doing at this current time. And, you know, and I think just keep at it, engage with the teams, come to governance days, find out about observer shifts. And there's only one extra thing I throw in. I think it's something that you've got absolutely bags of and demonstrate really well, and you're far too modest to ever say it, but that'll be to stay humble. And I think, yeah, you're one of the, you know, in terms of humility, you're one of the humblest guys doing the job at the moment, mate. So yeah, I think there's an awful lot to be said about that as well. Kieran, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, mate. So much good stuff there, and yeah, I wish you the best with the rest of your secondment, mate. I'm sure we'll all see you out and about at some point soon.
No, cheers, mate. Thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.